Well, choir, Mark, thank you so much. That was beautiful. Mark, your saxophone really makes that piece shine. And let me say to you that it's the perfect topic because we're talking about Jesus today. Specifically, young Jesus, the early years, the last 30 verses of the second chapter of Luke. If you've not done this, we're going to ask you one more time, go back and look at Luke. Just read the second chapter of Luke. And you'll find the four sermons. We're preaching on four different episodes in the young life of Jesus. The first two, and you can go back and you can get these as a video or audio podcast from the last two sermons, dealt with the time of Jesus in the temple or the synagogue. Next week, we return to the temple. So three of these four passages are about the time Jesus spent in the temple. This is the only passage that is about the young Jesus and his time spent at home. This is the first time I've ever preached these texts like this, and they've really been interesting. I've learned a lot, and I think we do learn a lot from young Jesus, believe it or not, and from Mary and Joseph, his parents, how to live our lives, how to raise our children. So today, just two verses. Mary and Joseph have been to the temple. They've gone through the ritual requirements of having a young child in the temple. Jesus has been circumcised and blessed. They've come back home, and these are the only two verses we have about Jesus and his home life. When they had finished, referring to Joseph and Mary, when they had finished everything required by the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee, to their own town of Nazareth. The child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom. Some translations say that he grew in stature and grew in wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I think if you or I were to write a biography of the most famous man who ever lived, we would want to do some research about his childhood, right? We'd want to maybe go back and interview some of the preschool teachers, maybe some of the grade school teachers, a coach from high school perhaps. We'd want to interview aunts and uncles as well as the parents. We'd want to gather as much information as possible. We'd want to know whether he was interested in sports. Did he play soccer? Was he in the chess club? Did he get all of his service hours in? Right, we can assume he was Jesus, after all. We can assume he got all of his service hours, right? You know, we'd want that kind of information. It's the kind of thing that would be important. I love those stories, for instance, about Einstein. You know, Einstein, maybe the greatest theoretical physicist who ever lived, this great mathematical mind, and yet we know from the biographies of Einstein that as a young child, he had trouble, he failed math. He had trouble doing simple math. His mind, I think that's an insightful story about Einstein. So we'd like to see that about Jesus, but guess what? We have none of that. And we're really not sure. Luke wrote this passage. We know that Jesus had at least a brother and a mother who were alive at the time of his crucifixion, his death, and his resurrection. They were around to be interviewed. We don't know whether Luke just didn't do the interviews, didn't know the information, or whether maybe he thought this is the only thing we really need to know about the young Jesus, that he grew in stature. That he grew in stature and that he was wise. He grew in wisdom and was in favor with God. Maybe that's all he wanted us to know. I think it's so interesting when he describes Jesus as growing in wisdom. That's not the way we typically would describe any child, right? We might have a child that's precocious, a child that is extremely intelligent, a child that's a prodigy. We might describe them as extremely intelligent, but we typically would not refer to a child as growing in wisdom, would we? There's a difference between wisdom and intelligence. I have an 11-year-old grandson by the name of Liam. He's a smart kid. A number of years ago, he was about three or four, maybe three, becoming four, late threes or early fours. We were out in the backyard, and he and I were playing and doing things, and an airplane came over, a jet out of DFW. I pointed it out to him. I said, Liam, look at the plane. He said, yeah, I see it. I said, where do you think they're going? And without any hesitation at all, he just said, to the airport. And you know, that was the moment in which I understood the remarkable truth that intelligence is inherited. It's just a matter of genes, from the grandfather to the son to the grandson. But we understand this, don't we? There is a difference between wisdom and intelligence. There's a difference between having the gift of wisdom and having a lot of information. I don't know how much you've thought about this, but I think about it a lot because I'm a self-learner. We live in the golden age of information. If you're a self-learner, it doesn't get any better than this. You can go to your computer, sit down, type in a few keystrokes, bring up Wikipedia, and you can learn about almost any subject whatsoever. I was a philosophy major in college. I can type in and brush up on Plato or Aristotle within about 20 or 25 minutes. At one time, I would have had to go to the library, go through the card file, go into the stacks, read through a bunch of books in order to get some kind of, you know, summary, brushing up on Aristotle or Plato. No more, just like that. I'm not good at science at all, but I can go to Wikipedia and I can bring up something like quantum mechanics and at least kind of have a working understanding of knowledge, pick up some of the ideas and words and theories involved in theoretical physics. It is a remarkable world in which we live. We have the most information and the most readily available information of any generation ever to live. And yet, I wonder if we have wisdom. You might have this experience in terms of information. Talk about readily available information. My wife, Bobby, and I, we're not football fanatics anymore, but we love football. We'll sit around and watch the football games this afternoon. And I don't know whether you do this or not, but this happened the other day. We were sitting there watching a game. It must have been a New England game. I turned and I said to Bobby, I said, I wonder how tall Tom Brady is. And she said, that's a good question. I just turned and I said, Alexa, how tall is Tom Brady? I'm not kidding, you can do this. And Alexa immediately will tell you when Tom Brady was born, how tall he is and how much he weighs. And you can do this with all sorts of things. You say, when does the next game start? There's a tremendous amount of information available to us. And then there's our smartphones. Our smartphones available to us all the time, and we can get that kind of information. Plus, you can take off from Plano and say, Siri, how do I get from Plano to First Methodist Church on Ross Avenue, downtown Dallas? Are you going to do it with Waze? And you know the drill. It'll just give you verbal step-by-step. You may have some stories like this. I was being guided by Waze the other day. Waze can be a little late. Have you ever noticed this? I was already into the intersection, and Waze said, turn left, and I almost did. I wouldn't be here today had I done it. You have to be a little careful. They're not always perfect. But we have these smartphones. It's remarkable what we can do. Tremendous amount of information at our fingertips. And yet sometimes, I wonder if our smartphones are making us dumber. Over the last 10 days, the Wall Street Journal, at least I personally read three articles out of the Wall Street Journal about a group of investors who are, we're talking about $2 billion investors, CalPERS and the Jhana Group, who are lobbying on the inside Apple to do things with their phones so that people can't be on the phone all the time. And it's partly a matter of social conscience for them, but it's also a matter of investment. They fear that when the research is known by everybody, that ultimately the result will be that the stock price of Apple will fall. So I've been reading these stories and about the research that I hadn't seen, and I like to watch PBS, the news hour at 6 o'clock. Earlier in the week, we want to show you this short video.
Super-connected kids are growing up less rebellious, more tolerant, less happy, and completely unprepared for adulthood. Thanks to you both for joining us. Dr. Twangy, let me begin with you. I think I know the answer from what the title of your book, but what can you tell us about what the research says about kids and iPhones?
So iGen is the first generation to spend their entire adolescence with smartphones, and that's had ripple effects across many areas of their lives. And one place that's showing up is in their mental health. So right around 2012, in these big samples of teens, there was a sudden and pretty large jump in symptoms of depression and anxiety and even clinical level depression and suicide among teens. And that happened right at the same time that smartphones became common. So there's also lots of studies showing links between mental health issues and time spent on electronic devices such as smartphones. So, for example, teens who spend 5 or more hours a day on electronic devices are 71% more likely to have at least one risk factor for suicide compared to teens who spend less than an hour a day.
And what makes smartphones different from, say, television or video games?
Well, smartphones can be carried into the bedroom. They're more portable, so they may interfere with sleep. And sure enough, the percentage of teens who don't sleep enough also spiked right around 2012, and that's a major risk factor for mental health issues. They can also be carried out of the house wherever you go. So that means that teens are often spending lots of time on those devices, even when they are with their friends in person. So with that said, of course, TV and video games are also linked to mental health issues, but the link isn't quite as strong as it is for smartphones and for social media.
And I know you've said that there are some beneficial aspects to smartphone use by kids. Is there sort of a sweet spot? How much is too much time on an iPhone?
Yeah, that's right. So teens who don't use digital media at all or don't use smartphones at all are actually a little less well-adjusted than teens who use them a little bit. So the sweet spot seems to be from less than an hour to an hour or so of use a day. And it's more than 2 hours, so 3 hours of use and beyond per day that is linked to that considerably higher risk of depression and other mental health issues.
At the first service, when I showed this, I love our teenagers around here, and I thought, well, I know they're going to clobber me. They're going to come up to me and say, come on, you're killing me. But after the last service, a young woman came out and shared with me her story. She said, my teenage daughter killed herself this past spring. Part of the reason, being bullied on an iPhone. So I want to say, no, I'm not killing you. Your phones might be killing you. And maybe our phones are making all of us a little bit dumber. I went to the dictionary. I do this often. I make my living with words. So I went to the dictionary and I looked up the meaning of the word wisdom. It was unsatisfying to me. Usually I like those definitions, but said wisdom is using good judgment. It's judicious. Wisdom is the same as sagacious. The word sagacious means being wise. I don't really think that gets to our understanding of wisdom here in this picture of Jesus growing in wisdom. I would say that wisdom is this. Wisdom is the ability to see the big picture. And wisdom is the ability to see all the way down the line. Wisdom is the ability to see ourselves in the midst of eternity, if you will. If you were to ask me to critique the secular world in which we live, and there's no doubt that we live in a secular world. Look, 4 decades ago, we were all connected with one another by institutions that had shared values, mostly shared values that have been pronounced to us by the Christian church. We understood that. We had a common understanding about our belief in God for the most part. Today, it's very, very different. It's not all bad. We won't ever go back to the way it was. We're much more diverse today. But part of the result of living in a more secular world is that we've lost this sense of transcendence, of the fact that there is a God that created us all and that brings us together, that we're all connected because of our understanding of God, and that there's a big picture. I have this, either your life has meaning and purpose or it doesn't. It either has meaning and purpose or it doesn't. And in so many ways, in the secular world in which you and I live, there's no sense that our lives have meaning and purpose. And so we just kind of live moment by moment. So for instance, we have a lot of football fans. If you're an Alabama fan, what a great moment you had not too long ago. If you're a Texas fan or an Aggie fan or an Oklahoma State fan, you can't wait till next year. Maybe that will be our moment. You'll have this great moment of triumph and victory. We live for these moments. Maybe the moment you live for is the opportunity to close the next deal, the next sale, or the next big deal. Maybe the moment you live for is the next big purchase or the next promotion. Maybe the moment you're living for is the next big step in your social life or your love life. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. Not a thing wrong with any of that. I mean, Jesus came into the world incarnate, God incarnate. That means in the flesh. We are to enjoy our lives in the flesh. We should enjoy and celebrate these joyful moments that we have. But is it possible that you and I are losing the sense of transcendence, that somehow it all makes sense, it all strings together and makes sense because our lives have meaning and purposefulness? You know, back to the iPhone for just a minute, or the smartphone, I don't want to pick on Apple, the smartphone. I mean, you and I see each other just living in the moment, don't we? I see you at lunch and you see me at lunch and we've got our phones out there and there we are going, obsessed with the moment. One of the things we know about our phones, maybe you don't know, maybe you haven't seen this research, is that they've been designed to give us a rush of adrenaline. So, if you post something on Facebook, look, I don't know very much about this, but if you post something on Facebook and you get a like, there's this rush of adrenaline. And when you read the research on this, it's the same kind of adrenaline rush that a person gets when they take something like morphine, or the same kind of rush that we get with sex. It's a really good feeling all over. And sometimes our teenagers are there moment by moment and they post something and there's no likes whatsoever, and the result, it's just the opposite. Nobody likes me. There's not a place for me in the world. This is about much, much more than just our smartphones. It's about our understanding of what is important in life and what is not so important in life. That's wisdom, isn't it? And isn't that why you come here every Sunday morning? It's not really that I'm going to share some kind of great insight with you that you've never heard of. It's that you come here every Sunday morning so I will remind you of what you already know. And that is that there are some things in life that are really, really important, and there are some things in life that aren't all that important. And so if you're a Jaguar fan or a Patriot fan or a Viking fan or an Eagle fan, you'll watch the games this afternoon, and win or lose, you may jump up in joy. We won, we won. You may be in tears. My favorite team lost. But sometimes it's helpful to think about the big picture and say, this is just one moment in time. It really doesn't determine whether my life is worthwhile or not. It isn't what gives me purpose and meaning in life. And when you make that next post on Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is, you say, in the big picture of things, the big scheme of things, this isn't all that important. When we begin to grow in wisdom, we begin to grow in our understanding that God is here with us, as Matthew tells us in the birth narrative, that God is with us. That there are some things that are eternal and lasting, and they're more important than anything else. And if we were just to use one little word for that, we would just use the word love, wouldn't we? That God is love. And that when we're connected by love, when we serve in love, when we reach out in love, we are doing God's work, and that's what's really important. That's what it means to grow in wisdom and to understand the favor of God, being blessed by God's favor upon you. This is such a little tiny phrase in the New Testament. It's just Luke, this little report from Luke saying that Jesus at a very young age grew in wisdom. And yet we know that he grew into the greatest teacher of wisdom who ever lived. He literally walked into the lives of people and reminded them of what is really important and what is not so important. And through the scriptures, he's walked into your life and mine and told us, your life is important. It has meaning and purpose, but it's about God. It's about love. May we be like Jesus. May we grow in wisdom and understanding. May we experience the favor of God as we do so.